True Seekers, Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. Thank you very much for tuning in. Let's see, where were we? It was last Thursday night, right? Just technical problems. It's the magical, wonderful world of radio. But we are back. I got an email right before the program here from Teresa in Spring, Texas. And Teresa writes, Mike, and then in, oh, I guess this is 20-point caps, boldface. She writes, Mike, please don't bombard us with more MLK speeches and the dissections of him and those speeches. I have had enough of this topic. I ain't a KKK card-carrying member. Eyes black. Perhaps you can discuss where I can get some of the 10 cents a gallon gas that I've heard about. My car is screaming for a fill-up that's a whole lot less than $60. I got a minivan because I may need to sleep in it. It was a hurricane escape vehicle, but because of the thievery going on in every seam of our society and the escalating cost of this thievery on my society, on the society, I may be forced to flip my ride into a bed. And this is a real reality show. Let's talk about this. Thank you. Signed, Teresa, still running from Hurricane Obscenity, Hurricane Blank, from Spring, Texas. She signs herself an old internet listening chick. Yeah, okay. You actually kind of read my mind, Teresa. No, I don't do MLK speeches, and I'll tell you why. Because it kind of ties in with my way of thinking about this. And I know I'm going to get some flack here, but I'm going to say it anyway. White people should not be talking about the Martin Luther King experience or the black experience. Or, you know, I was flipping around today and I hear all these white commentators on the various cable channels and over the air, and especially Chris Matthews and all, you know, all these white people talking about King's legacy. And the thought occurred to me, what in the hell do white people know about Martin Luther King's legacy? I mean, that's an impossibility. White people can approach this whole thing from one angle only, intellectually. That's it. That's it. Now, Martin Luther King may have been an intellectual, but he was not talking about intellectual stuff. He was talking about from the gut, from the heart. He was talking about your soul. He was talking about justice. He was talking about equality. He was talking about peace and freedom and love and togetherness and what these right-wing sons of bitches now call kumbaya. Let's all get together and sing it. That's exactly what Dr. King was talking about. No, I don't talk about Dr. King because I do not have the right to talk about Dr. King. I can say, ooh, today's the King holiday, and then it's time for me to move on. That's all I can say. That's all I can say. And it just irritates the hell out of me. I can't imagine how black folk must feel, any black folk that are paying attention, because the Martin Luther King holiday has been trivialized to the point where it's almost non-existent. It doesn't mean anything. It's a day when they don't come by and pick up your garbage. It's a day when there's some sales somewhere, or I don't know. It's a chance for politicians, white politicians, to go someplace that they would never go to unless they were looking for votes, and that is a black church. So I'll tell you what. No, Teresa, I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to play any of his speeches. It's all out there for people who want to hear it. But the only thing white people should be doing about the MLK holiday or MLK or anything about it is trying to educate ourselves. That's all. In other words, here's what white people need to do regarding the Martin Luther King holiday. Sit down and shut up. Just shut up. And if you want to be all brotherly and prove your, I ain't got nothing against Negroes, then sit down and shut up and listen to the speeches. And when you're finished listening to the speeches, don't call somebody up and talk about it. Just shut up. And listen, read his speech from the Riverside Church right before the government shot his ass dead. Read that. Go back and read letters from a Birmingham jail and then shut up. Don't talk about you've had some revelation. Don't talk about, oh, well, uh-huh, brotherhood, good old Dr. King, yes, sir, uh-huh. And they're going back to your nasty-ass white people way. You know what I'm talking about because I'm white. You know what I'm talking about. You know what I am talking about. So I'll tell you what. In honor of Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to shut up. And I just strongly recommend that all white people do the same thing. Don't come on with your condescension. Don't come on with your patronizing attitude about the great Reverend King. You don't give a goddamn about Dr. King, and you know you don't. So you want to know what he was about? Read his speeches. Read his sermons. White folks, and then shut up. The only people you should be talking to Dr. King about is your children. Okay? We on the same page here? Everything cool? All right? Huh? Did I piss everybody off now? Huh? 5 minutes in the show, I've already used the GD word and talked about white people should shut up. Damn good thing I'm white, huh? Let's move on. Watch what happens tomorrow morning when the Dow Jones Industrial Average is first posted on CNN, down there in the lower right-hand corner of the screen, right after they do Eastern Time and Central Time and Pacific Time, and then, boop, there it comes, the Dow, and then the NASDAQ, and then the S&P. Watch where it is tomorrow. There is some hellacious stuff coming. I've been reading something today from Bloomberg.com and also from the Associated Press business writer Toby Anderson. Stocks plunge worldwide amid pessimism over U.S. stimulus plan. We were closed today because of that holiday. The stock market was closed today because of that holiday. And isn't that funny? The stock market closing because of MLK. Stocks fell sharply worldwide, all over the planet today. All over the planet. Europe, Asia, Central and South, or South America, the UK, Germany, France. I mean, it just goes on and on. Canada, Hong Kong, India. Everything right into the crapper. And you know why? Because of what Bush announced last week, his plan to rescue an economy that he has destroyed, and that the hedge fund managers in New York have destroyed, the greedy sons of bitches who took a look about 7 years ago and said, you know what? Do you know what? Do you remember back in the 80s? You remember the SNL thing? Do you remember Enron? Son of a bitch, we haven't done something like this long. Come on, let's go. We're going to come up with something here called, and then they listed all those little funny words that you and I have no idea what they're talking about. But the real players started putting money here and money there, and all the investors from all over the world started, yeah, let's get on board that horse. Woo! And they rode that sucker. Man, did they ride it. Now look what's happening. Huh? Did you make money? I damn sure didn't. I don't know anybody who did. But somebody made a ton of it, right? Now, guess who is going to be left cleaning up the vomit? Who's going to be left cleaning up the diarrhea? Who's going to be left cleaning up the bloodstains on the wall? That's right, you and I, like we always are, right? Huh? Watch what happens when the stock market opens tomorrow, the Dow Jones Industrial Averages. You might have a bottle of Bufferin close by. I just look around, he's gone home. Didn't you love the thing that they stood for? Didn't they try to find some good for you and me? Then we'll be free someday.
You're working hard to put food on your family.
Twenty-one past the hour. The presidential race too is just—is it not out of control? I can't believe what I'm seeing with the Democrats. And of course the media are just—they're just pumped. They love to see this. They got the black man and the white woman fighting with each other. And got old Slick Willie in the middle of it. America's real first black president. Chuckle, chuckle, har, har. And don't media love this? Huh? Aren't they the ones that report it and flash it around and hand it over to these beasts like Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and the rest of these filthy pigs so they can make a big issue about what these people are saying in the heat of their campaign? And what's up with Obama? I'm going to get in his ass tonight about his statement about Ronald Reagan. Oh, my God. Obama, let me tell you something. Any thought I had about voting for you went down the crapper with that one, buddy. Adios. Have a nice life. Not the least bit interested, pal. I put you now with Hillary. So you and Hillary, go on over there. Go out there somewhere. Go way over there and have your fight. And get Bill involved in it too. Me, I'm going to be focusing on John Edwards. Since I can't have the person I really want, I'm going to focus on John Edwards. But Obama and Hillary, y'all go ahead, go over there and scratch each other's eyes out. Just hurl your crap back and forth, and don't forget to drag the rest of the Democratic Party into your circular firing squad. Because all y'all are crazy. You're all crazy. Every damn one of you are crazy. We're faced with the crap we're faced with, and you two are having a bitch fight about who's the blackest or who's the most female? What in the hell is going on? And Bill Clinton, somebody ought to say to Bill Clinton, come here, Willie, here, take this intern and go sit down and amuse yourself. Get the hell out of this race. Slick Willie had better shut up. Slick Willie is doing the almost unthinkable and impossible. He's turning the entire black nation against the Democratic Party. Son of a bitch! Slick Willie, let me tell you something. You were not the first black first black president. Whoever told you, who told you that? James Carville? Who told you that? Who got in your ear and said you were you are not. You never were. You are white. How many black people did you send to death row with your crime bills? How many black women did you cause to go into the street and become crack hoes because of your welfare reform? Get out of here, Willie. You are not black. You are not. And Barack Obama is trying to restrain himself from telling anyone who listened, yo, I'm black. He's not. This is insane. This is craziness. Meanwhile, what's going on over the Republican side? Huckabee? McCain? Romney? Well, at least after the Florida primary, Giuliani drops. I mean, goodbye, Mr. Giuliani. 9-11, 9-11, 9-11. Goodbye, Rudy. Rudolph the red-nosed freakoid. You're gone. I don't know what your plan was, but thank God you worked it. Get out of here. Go on home. Get out of town, Rudy. All right? Goodbye. Man, I'm sick of him. I'm sick of all of them. I'm just less sick of, I'm not really sick of Edwards. And then I read today that, how old is Ralph Nader? 74, 73? He's thinking about getting the race. Oh, okay. Do that. You know what's going to happen? The Democrats are going to piss away the best opportunity they've had to save America since FDR. That's what the Democrats are going to do. You know it as well as I do. You feel it in your gut. In the first place, there is no Democrat out there who's an FDR. The only one that might come close, that might, who's in the running, who's really in the running, I'm not talking about Kucinich, he has as much chance as I do, is Edwards. But there is no FDR out there. But even if there isn't, with what the Republicans, the conservatives, the religious Christian Taliban and Huckabees and freakoids, what they have done to this country in the past 8 years is just astonishing. They've almost destroyed us. It's almost over. The curtain is ready to fall. And what are we doing? Amusing ourselves, watching Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton call each other who's the darkest and who's the most female. Son of a bitch, I don't believe this is happening. But it is! That's where we are. That's where we are. So in the midst of all that, one of these Republican bastards is going to squeak in. I don't know which one it's going to be, but one of them, watch what happens. With the way the machines are rigged and the way the Democrats are so intent on trying to prove who's really the first black president, who's really the first female president, all this talk and counter talk and back and forth and jibe nonsense, you know what's going to happen. You know it, and I know it. Some weaselly-ass Republican is going to go bleep and slip right into the Oval Office, and then it's Katie bar the door. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
People, now that they've realized I'm going to seek re-election, expect me to seek re-election.
Well, then seek re-election, freak. Here's what Obama said, quote, "I don't want to present myself as some sort of singular figure. I think part of what's different are the times. I do think that, for example, the 1980s were different. I think Ronald Reagan changed the trajectory of America in a way that Richard Nixon did not, and in a way that Bill Clinton did not. He, Reagan, put us on a fundamentally different path because the country was ready for it. I think they felt like with all the excesses of the 60s and 70s, and government had grown and grown, but there wasn't much sense of accountability in terms of how it was operating. I think people, well, Reagan just tapped into what people were already feeling, which was, we want clarity, we want optimism, we want to return to that sense of dynamism and entrepreneurship that has been missing," end quote. Oh my God, where to begin? Either Barack Obama is, because of his age, incredibly ignorant of the 80s, or Barack Obama, because he was talking to a newspaper with a conservative editorial board, was being was trying to play them for fools to get their endorsement, which he got. It's either one or the other. For Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton or Joe Blow or your grandmammy to make a statement about Reagan like that, that he put us on a fundamentally different path because the country was ready for it, because he changed things. He put us on a trajectory. He moved us. Oh, yes. And in the context of the way he was saying it, let's not misunderstand, Truth Seeker, he was praising Reagan. So, my friend Lance in Manhattan writes, didn't Obama just get his dander up when Hillary seemed to marginalize Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.? One week later, Obama is not only marginalizing, but ripping Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., John Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Malcolm X, the Civil Rights Movement, the Women's Movement, the Union Movement, and the real greatest American generation. Obama claims Ronald Reagan fixed what to Obama must have been the disaster that was the 60s and 70s. Well, Obama can explain his twisted thinking better with his own insane words, and then the quote there that I just shared with you. And as Lance writes, let's take it apart. Optimism. Obama says that that we wanted optimism, and Reagan gave it to us. Okay, optimism. I wonder if the tens of thousands of butchered priests, nuns, teachers, and social activists in Central America felt optimistic about Ronald Reagan's administration. Can't help but wonder if the union members Mr. Reagan spied upon for Joe McCarthy back in the 50s felt clarity as they had their lives ruined by a cowardly pack of sniveling un-American hate mongers. I wonder if the millions of union members felt inspired by Reagan when they lost their living wage jobs under Reagan's changed trajectory and their families wound up with both parents working like dogs just to get by, leaving the children to be raised by strangers in day dump centers that thrived under the family values of Ronald Reagan. And do you think the Iranians have any of those weapons left that Reagan gave them as payment to keep Americans held hostage so he could live in the White House? Do you think our soldiers will be optimistic about that when they enter Iran in the very near future? Can't help but ponder whether real fiscal conservatives were patriotically moved as Mr. Mount Rushmore slaughtered Roosevelt's safety net and what Barack Obama calls the excesses of the 60s and the 70s, slaughtered it all, replacing them with nonstop military-industrial complex stealing, the largest deficits in the history of the country up to that point. Barack seems proud of Reagan's work attacking the excesses of feeding the hungry, the excesses of civil rights, the excesses of a living wage, the excesses of helping those in need, and the excesses of expecting the government to address the needs of the people. Can't have that. No, 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 no. Like Barack says, Reagan replaced that nonsense and brought about a sense of dynamism that comes when a country runs its national credit card over the max so that rich white people can stop being oppressed by the excesses of the 60s and the 70s. How about redefining the concept of freedom? I bet the Founding Fathers would be just Jim Dandy with being compared to the freedom fighter butchers known as the Sandinistas. Remember when George Washington's army attacked all those churches and schools, killing every man, woman, and child they could get their bayonets into? Another positive Reagan change that Barack apparently feels motivated by. Instead of Sandinistas, I think what I know Lance, what he meant was the Contras. Remember when Reagan said that the Contras, an organization that was created by the CIA to go murder people, Reagan referred to them as the moral equivalent of our founding fathers? Hey, Barack, are you not familiar with that? Back to Lance. Well, I'm sure by this point you realize just how motivated I was by the strange Obama-Reagan love-in. I'd like to change Mr. Obama's excessive rhetoric and find a new trajectory for it. Maybe in a corporate garbage can. That would be poetic justice, for Obama surely is corporate garbage. Lance in Manhattan, Illinois. Yeah. See, to Barack Obama, what happened in the 80s... Let's go back to 84, 24 years ago. Barack Obama was, what, 22? I don't think at the time, I'm just guessing, I have no idea, but I don't think Barack Obama was focused on the murderous policies of Ronald Reagan where it concerned the Central America. Amy Goodman interviewed Alan Nairn. Alan, we are now hearing in the United States a great deal about Reagan foreign policy couched as a war against communism. Can you respond to that and talk specifically about Guatemala and El Salvador? Alan Nairn, who is a journalist. Well, communism was the excuse for what Reagan did in Central America, but the victims were not communists. The victims were priests and peasants and labor leaders and residents and student leaders and academics and journalists and others who, both in Guatemala and Salvador, had coalesced into strong popular movements. The thing they were responding to was the fact that in both those countries, hundreds of thousands of people every year were dying unnecessarily from malnutrition, from diarrhea, from malaria. People were living on hillsides trying to eke out a living on corn crops that could only feed a family for 3 or 4 months, because the garden plot was so small, because the larger owners had all the good land. People tried to find a peaceful solution to this preventable death, mainly of children. In many villages in Guatemala and El Salvador, half the kids would die through peaceful means, through strikes on the plantations where they would ask for an extra 40 cents a day in wages, strikes in places like the Coca-Cola plant in Guatemala, calls for enforcement of the real minimum wage. The response to this by the militaries of El Salvador and Guatemala, in both cases backed by the Reagan administration, the response was death squads. In Guatemala, they had names like Mala Blanca, the White Hand, the SR, the secret anti-communist army. They would often pass out leaflets listing the names of the people they intended to execute. Sometimes they were illustrated with the photos. They complied. They would follow up. They would roam the streets and in vans and would come into houses in the middle of the night wearing hoods. They would drag people away, and in the next few days their mutilated bodies would turn up by the roadside, often with the genitals removed, stuffed in the mouth, hands severed. This was effective. It worked. The popular movements in both Salvador and Guatemala were crushed. And in response, many of the survivors went to the hills. They joined up with very small, until that time, guerrilla groups, several of which had a communist ideology and were backed by Cuba. And they tried to fight that way. When they did that, that was seen by Reagan and his people, Alexander Haig, the Secretary of State Gene Kilpatrick, Elliot Abrams, the human rights and Latin American chief John Negroponte, the ambassador to Honduras. This was seen as their strategic success because it made it that much easier politically for the U.S. to justify what it was doing. They can say, see, we're fighting communists. We're fighting an armed insurgency. That's why we're backing these governments. What they backed was really one of the most intensive campaigns of mass murder in recent history. In Guatemala, during Reagan's time, 200,000 civilians were massacred. A couple of thousand armed guerrillas were killed in combat. In Salvador, probably on the order of 70,000 civilians massacred. Again, a couple of them were armed guerrillas killed in combat. While Reagan was running for president against Carter in 1980, his campaign and foreign policy team actually sent emissaries to Guatemala. They met with the military chiefs and the heads of CASIF, which was the Guatemalan Chamber of Commerce, Agriculture, Industry, and Finance, the convening body. They told them, according to the discussions that I had with the people that they met with, that once Reagan came to office, they would have a freer hand. They had been getting some criticism from the State Department of Ford and then Carter, and the U.S. Congress, to its credit, had brought correct and direct U.S. arms sales to Guatemala. So with approval from the National Security Advisor to President Carter, Israel stepped in to fill the gap and was selling automatic rifles and Uzi submachine guns and transport planes and military goods to the government of Guatemala, but they had to do it indirectly. The U.S. was, it was difficult for the Guatemalan army. Reagan's campaign emissaries told the death squad chieftains and the oligarchy and the military, "Don't worry. When we come in, you'll get a free hand. When we get elected, you'll get a free hand." And that's basically what happened. One of the people that went down on behalf of President Reagan was Vernon Walters, who was his special emissary to Guatemala. More in a second.
Warship, if he dies, he wants to go out in style. And there's nothing to eat that don't carry the stink of certain waste dumped in the Nile. Well, one thing is certainly true, no one here knows what to do, and I'm sick of you. I'm sick of you.
Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
It's about 9 before the hour. Back to this interview on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and journalist Alan Nairn. I'm quoting from Alan Nairn. And this is in response to what Barack Obama said last week. Regarding Reagan, he said, "I think Reagan changed the trajectory of America in a way that Nixon did not and Clinton did not. Reagan put us on a fundamentally different path because the country was ready for it. I think they, I guess the country, felt like with all the excesses of the 60s and 70s, and government had grown and grown, but there wasn't much sense of accountability in terms of how it was operating. If Barack Obama sees the Reagan years as an example of accountability, then Barack Obama ought to go back to the Illinois state legislature and mature just a little bit, pal." And I'm usually not one to tell other Democrats what to do, but this, his statement was just an outrage. Anyway, back to Alan Nairn. The ruler of Guatemala was General Lucas Garcia. Under his reign, the military focused its attacks on unions and on peasant groups and also on the Catholic Church, which they saw as a subversive force because it was telling the poor that they also were human in the sight of God, that they had rights, and that they had the right to ask for more. On two occasions, the military death squads actually went in and abducted the entire labor leadership of Guatemala, which was holding conventions. They picked them all up. They disappeared, never to be seen again. On behalf of Ronald Reagan, Vernon Walters went down, met publicly with General Lucas Garcia, and embraced him, and said, "We love your devotion to peace, liberty, and constitutional institutions." About a year and a half later, when General Lucas Garcia was replaced by General Luis Mons, who took power in a coup, the strategy shifted. Mons shifted to the countryside, the Mayan highlands of the Northwest, where the indigenous population, and especially old and brave, and they were more impoverished than the people of the cities, and they had risen against the armies. So the new government sent the army sweeping through the villages of the highlands and actually saw military documents where they estimated that 662 rural villages were annihilated. They would go to the villages. They would gather everyone in the square. They would tell them that the army had arrived, that they were only, their only hope for survival was to come to the good and to renounce those who were against the military. And then they would read from lists compiled by the military intelligence of people who were supposedly giving food to the guerrillas or working with the priests or working with organizers. And then they would execute them in front of the other villagers. They would shoot them in the head with their Uzis. They would make the neighbors then dig a pit into which the bodies were thrown. And then they would often grab several people from the crowd, shoot them at random, and often these were the kids. Then as they left, they would burn the homes, slaughter the farm animals, and they did this day after day after day. On some days, 3, 4, and 5 villages would be taken out in this manner. They would leave behind these burning hulks, decapitated bodies, often hundreds, slaughtered at a time. Then in the midst of this campaign, Reagan personally went to Central America, met with General Luis Mons, and said that Guatemala was getting a bum rap on human rights. There's a similar story in neighboring El Salvador. As with Guatemala, the U.S. policy of backing terror and backing an oligarchy which lived high while many thousands of children died from hunger, the U.S. policy of backing them went back a long way. In Guatemala in 1954, Eisenhower sent them the CIA to overthrow the democratically elected government and put the army in power. Likewise, in Salvador, a sophisticated military death squad apparatus had been built up under a program launched under JFK, the Kennedy administration, which actually sent in the CIA and the State Department and Green Beret people to set up a communication system, at that time a radio teletype, which was the technology of the day, which linked the intelligence services of Guatemala, Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, and they would exchange across borders information they had gathered on subversives, information they had gathered with CIA assistance in files that they, I have actually been shown some of the files in Salvador by the officers explaining how the CIA technicians had shown them how to put them together and maintain them. This was before the advent and wide use of computers. They did it with paper. But they managed to find their victims. Through the 60s and 70s, they carried out many assassinations. But when Reagan came in, it became large scale. It became more systematic. At one point, there was a famous incident in which a group of American nuns and church workers were waylaid on a road, abducted by elements of the troops of the Salvadoran National Guard. They were raped and murdered. Afterward, Alexander Haig, Reagan's Secretary of State, suggested that they had died in an exchange of gunfire, that these were pistol-packing nuns who apparently got what they deserved. Jean Kirkpatrick said that, well, these were not real nuns. She suggested they were up to some, that they were up to no good, perhaps helping the poor of El Salvador. One of the people who in the mid-80s, from 1984 to 86, actually ran the U.S. military operation in El Salvador, Colonel James Steele, who is currently in Baghdad, he's the counselor for Iraqi security forces. He's in charge of putting together and training the Iraqi security forces. Elliot Abrams, who was really second only to Kirkpatrick as an ideologue and planner of the Central American massacres, is now running Middle East policy at the National Security Council for the Bush administration. We'll be back in a moment while I continue my education of Barack Obama. Welcome back. About 6:30 past the hour. Just about finished with this interview an interview conducted by Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! With journalist Alan Nairn. Alan Nairn did a lot of reporting as did Robert Perry, from Central America, from El Salvador and Guatemala. And the discussion between Alan Nairn and Amy Goodman was about this idolization of Ronald Reagan, who arguably was one of the worst presidents in the history of this country until George W. Bush came along. But the mythology is there, and nobody ever kicks the hell out of the mythology. Nobody talks about the hundreds of thousands of people that were slaughtered because of Reagan policies. So at the very towards the end of this interview, Alan Nairn says regarding the Reagan administration and his policies in Central America in the 80s, Alan Nairn says, well, I think if accurate history is written in the future, this will be seen as one of the great crimes of history. And in the U.S., I'm hearing about how Reagan is celebrated, and I don't know. I suspect that a lot of people in Central America, when they hear about that, maybe feel the same way that a lot of Americans feel when they hear the stories about people in other countries wearing Osama bin Laden T-shirts, you know, a feeling of just complete dismay and disgust. How can people do that? How can people celebrate such a mass killer? That's a complicated question. There are various reasons why people celebrate mass killers. One of them, that especially applies in the case of the U.S., is maybe they don't know. Maybe they don't know that Reagan was a mass murderer. And that is largely the case with what happened in Central America because of the way the U.S. press covered it and failed to not stand for it. And failed to cover it so the facts never got through to the American public. If they did, people would not stand for it. But Reagan, one thing you have to say for Reagan, and one thing I think you have to say for Bush now, they justly and appropriately, for politics, spoke in terms of good and evil. Because a lot of politics is good and evil. But he lied about it. Reagan lied about it. What he did was evil. What Bush is doing now is evil when he causes the deaths of civilians. Americans have to face the facts. They have to look at things the way they really are. And then you can't do anything about the victims of El Salvador and Guatemala now, but you can do something about those who are still alive. For example, I mentioned Coca-Cola in Guatemala. Dozens of union organizers there were gunned down by death squads. Almost the same things has happened in recent years at the Coca-Cola franchise in Colombia. One union leader pops up and he's gunned down. This practice is continuing, and it has to stop. So to Mr. Barack Obama, and to the entire field of Republican panderers and whores who try to pretend like they are the new Reagan, do you people not understand what this murderous bastard was about? Does nobody understand? Forget Central America. It wasn't our blood that was shed. Except for a few American priests and nuns, huh? And social workers. But forget all that. How about just focus on domestic policy? From the time of the founding of this republic up until the end of the Carter administration, this country, the debt, had never reached $1 trillion. After 2 years of Reagan, it was there. And look at it now. What is it now? $9 trillion? What is the real U.S. debt? $11 trillion? $14 trillion? This is a result of foreign policies, not just Republicans, although the Republicans are the most egregious. The Republicans are the most hypocritical. They're the slimiest. They're the most lying. But it's been the result of U.S. foreign policy for a long time. So what do we do about it? Do we put into the Oval Office Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton so he can say, "Hey, by God, it happened in my generation. Hey, we got a woman president. Now we're just like India. Now we're just like Israel. Now we're just like Germany. Now we're just like Canada. Now we're just like Great Britain. Ah, we've had a woman leader." Not to mention Central American or South American countries. Or do we say, "Wow, we're no longer racist. Look, we put a black man in the president. Oh, we're just like. Is that what this is all about? It is, isn't it? It is. Eric writes from New York, "Mike, yesterday at the Riverside Church in New York City where I sang in the choir, an unidentified audio clip was played of Dr. King which seemed to presage the actions of the Bush administration. Here's the quote. Midnight is the hour when men desperately seek to obey the 11th commandment, thou shalt not get caught. According to the ethic of midnight, the cardinal sin is to be caught, and the cardinal virtue is to get by. It's all right to lie, but one must lie with real finesse. It's all right to steal if one is so dignified that, if caught, the charge becomes embezzlement, not robbery. It is permissible even to hate. If one so dresses his hating in the garments of love, that hating appears to be loving. The Darwinian concept of the survival of the fittest has been substituted by a philosophy of the survival of the slickest. This mentality has brought a tragic breakdown of moral standards, and the midnight of moral degeneration deepens." End quote. Eric writes, in closing, Ronald Reagan may have lulled many into thinking that it was morning in America, but George Bush has truly reset the clock. I have a hard time with all this. You know, I really do. And I guess it's because, to me, this is not history. You know, Central America, the overthrow of Mohammed Mossadegh, the overthrow of Arbenz in Guatemala, the execution, the assassination of Diem in South Vietnam, the murder of just literally thousands of freedom fighters in the Philippines during the Marcos regime in the 60s and 70s, supported by U.S. dictators, apartheid in South Africa, It's not history to me. This is the stuff that I read. You know, when I was 11 years old, I was up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I had a little paper out, and it was in the winter. And I'm folding papers. I think it was in the winter. And I'm folding papers, and I always used to read the newspaper. And there I read it: Stalin dies, or was it Stalin dead? But it's not history to me. It's the stuff that I watched and listened to and was terrified of. And Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton or Hucklenuck or any of these freaks are going to sit back and dump platitudes on me? On you? What, does nobody remember what the Contras were? Does nobody remember what Oliver North set up in this country? The detention camps in case we did invade Nicaragua to put American dissenters in? That is a matter of record. Nobody remembers Elliot Abrams. Nobody remembers these monstrous sons of bitches and the slaughter and the death and destruction. And now we have some apparently juvenile 46-year-old senator from Illinois and some freaked-out woman from where in the hell, from New York, going to sit there and both Democrats and tell me that one is blacker than the other and one is more female than the other, and for that reason I should stand up and cheer? No, goddammit, no. Give me somebody who understands U.S. history, just in the past 40 years, you know, that we don't call history. Just for God's sake, just go back to 61, 62. That's all. That's all I'm asking for. And accept it. Fess up. Face it. Tell the American people the truth. And then let's move on. If that's possible, you know what I'm saying?
The pain will be over soon. Take a deep breath. Find your happy place. It's more of Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. All right, here's the here's the last one on this topic. But I got an email here from Bina. Excuse me. Mike, maybe it's not my place to say this as a white Canadian woman who was just a baby in diapers when Dr. King was killed. Obviously, I have no grand and glorious MLK experiences to share, so I'll try to spit my bit without resorting to the usual media encomiums and pablum about him. God knows we've all heard enough of those today. What I guess I'm trying to say is I'm sick of the way the media, excuse me, have trivialized Dr. King by narrowing his message down to voting rights for blacks. That is the very least of what he was about. When I listened to Democracy Now!'s podcast about him last year, the thing that struck me was how brilliantly Dr. King tied together the plagues of not only black America, but all America, and indeed all the world. He tied the anti-democratic disenfranchisement of voters to the war, then it was Vietnam, now it's Iraq, to capitalism. Dr. King was very astute about the way capitalism relates both to war and to democratic deficits. The disenfranchised voter is also the most likely to be the disenfranchised cog in the economy, and therefore the most likely to be sent to war. After what happened in Florida in 2000 and Ohio in 2004, and what I'm sure will happen again this year, it's so obvious, isn't it? Nothing has really progressed in America since Dr. King died. Poor folks, predominantly black and Hispanic, are still being denied the right to vote because we know they will vote for the candidate most likely to make something better for them. And we can't have that. We got to have them hungry and desperate for any scrap of honor or recognition or plugged nickel they can get. They don't get to vote or have the vote count the way it would for an affluent white guy behind a big oak desk. But when it comes to warm bodies to ship to Iraq and feed the military-industrial complex, oh yeah, come on in. Stay out of the polling station and come into the nice, cozy recruiter's office, folks. You're not welcome there, but you are welcome here. We need you to keep the defense contractors' stocks rising. Dr. King understood all that perfectly well. That's why he put his life on the line, and that's why he died. He knew he probably wouldn't be able to talk like that and live for very long, and how right he was. The FBI stalked him at every move. His dossier was probably thicker than your arm is long, and I wouldn't be surprised if the CIA contracted a hitman to finish him in the very year the Vietnam War was at its worst. People all across the land were drawing the same conclusions as he was. They were connecting the dots. Killing him was meant, I think, to send a message. Don't even try to stand up against this system. If calling you a nigger lover won't dissuade you, then maybe a bullet to the head of your favorite black spokesman will. I'm hoping that this devastating murder didn't dissuade the people who were really trying to change things, but in light of all that's happened since, I don't feel good. Just look at us all. How apathetic our society has become. Capitalism has gone from fat to obscenely obese, and the appetite is getting more voracious at an exponential rate from year to year, which is why a once-a-year feel-good day of solemn MLK worship won't cut it for me. It's going to take more than just one day a year to honor his memory for real. And obviously, it's going to take a hell of a lot more than just a singular fixation on what he did for the black folks. We all have to keep drawing the lines between the dots the same way he did. We have to work daily in small ways to overcome the divides, not only races, but classes. We all have to speak out the way he did. We have to recognize that he was not just about civil rights for people of color, but he was doing his damnedest to keep the capitalist money god from swallowing any more warm bodies, black, brown, yellow, or white, so that an already overprivileged few could become even more insulated from the dumb, ugly world they've created. So, yeah. By all means, tell the media to stuff their hokey fake idolatry of their token black saint. Martin Luther King was nobody's token anything. To isolate him from the vast and varied movement for social and economic justice as they are doing is despicable, even if they do it in hushed and reverential tones and nonstop coast-to-coast, wall-to-wall coverage. When will they take up his mission in earnest? Never. Because they're owned by the same corporations that are getting rich from wars that kill poor people of every color. By the way, why the hell was Obama praising Reagan? Not only was Reagan responsible for the big national downturn that's coming to a head now, and not only was he responsible for the gross human rights violations in Central America during the 80s, he was also stinkingly racist. Remember, Reagan left the Democrats around the time the Democrats decided to embrace the black and Hispanic voter. They did not leave him. He kicked off his 1980 election campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, the site of the infamous murders of two white civil rights workers and a black driver. Coincidence? Not a chance in hell. Reagan was a racist old son of a bitch, and to think that someone like Barack Obama would praise him is absurd to the point of nausea. Perhaps Obama is suffering from dementia too, but his lucid delivery makes me doubt that very much. The so-called excesses of the 60s strike me as nothing of the sort. They were just the bare beginnings of real, cryingly necessary changes. If that's what Reagan reversed, then may he rot in hell, and may all his worshippers join him shortly. I never saw bag ladies or homeless people in my life until Reagan came into office, and suddenly they were everywhere, and the media was pretending this was some kind of mystery, or that they were choosing to live on the streets. And when the Reagan CIA was shown to have started the crack cocaine epidemic that landed so many people on the streets, the reporter who broke the story was dismissed as a tinfoil hatter. Sorry, I'm rambling, but this all hangs together. To hell with the big media if they can't connect the dots, Mike. You can, and I can, and we both know why they won't. Bina.
Faster than a flying monkey, more powerful than a special prosecutor, it's Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio.
Welcome back. It's 26 before the hour. Let's get some calls in here before we do any more Malloy commentary. Leanne is calling from San Diego, listening on the internet. Hey, Leanne. Hey, Leanne. All right, let's put Leanne on hold. We'll get her in a minute. Will is calling from Michigan. Hey, Will, listening on Sirius. Hey, Will.
Hey, Mike. I wanted to call in and talk to you about another anniversary that we're marking today. Today's the 17th anniversary of the start of Operation Desert Storm.
Wow. Time just rips by when you're having fun, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess. I'm starting a legislative effort here in Michigan with the state legislature to get some help for our veterans to get tested for depleted uranium exposure.
Oh, good, good.
And
good.
It's a nationwide initiative, and so far we've been successful in getting state laws passed in Connecticut and Louisiana, and we want to get more states on board with this. Because this is the same tactic that veterans advocates used after Vietnam to bring Agent Orange to the public attention.
Well, what kind of response are you going to get?
We're hoping to get some legislation passed in Michigan to help provide advocates for veterans to get through the red tape of federal testing and stuff like that, so that we can collect evidence to go before congressional hearings, get the VA to acknowledge depleted uranium as a veteran's health issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish you the best. I hope it works, given the fact that Michigan is in almost an absolute depression.
Yeah, we've got the highest unemployment rate in the country right
well,
now.
Well, what I'm thinking about is how does that translate to funds available for, or is this? Are you looking? This can't be an unfunded state mandate. It has to have money coming from someplace. I'm not trying to pee on the parade here. I'm just saying, Will, good luck with it because, you know, where it concerns veterans, nobody cares about veterans. You know, you're a veteran.
Right. Well, the funding would come from the federal government because it's their mess and they should clean it up. So it's basically forcing the federal government to take care of the responsibilities.
Well, I hope it works, pal.
I'm sitting here with a friend here. She says she reminded me that I had to go to Montreal to be tested for depleted uranium exposure.
Oh my God. Well, once the U.S. government admits to the use of, you know, it goes back to Clinton.
Right. Well, no, it goes back. The first time it was used in combat was during the 1973 Yom Kippur War.
All right. The first time it was used by American military, it's my understanding,
1991, was 1991, Desert Storm.
I think it was before. All right, Desert Storm. You're right. And then Clinton used it in the mid '90s in his attack on or the NATO attack on Serbia.
Right.
So, all right. Well, listen. excuse me. Let us know how it works. All right, Will.
Okay. Happy belated birthday, Kathy.
She's nodding her head and saying thank you. All right. Take care, Will. I appreciate you checking in. Let me revisit this Barack Obama thing one more second. I've gotten several emails from people who seem to feel that my criticism of Obama where it concerns Reagan is undeserved, that what Barack Obama was actually doing was criticizing Reagan. I beg to differ. If you want to criticize somebody, you come out and you say the policy sucked, the man was a psychopath, only you clean it up a little bit. That's Malloy talk. Here's what he said. I don't want to present myself as some sort of singular figure. I think part of what's different are the times. I do think, for example, the 1980s were different. I think Ronald Reagan changed the trajectory of America in a way Richard Nixon did not, in a way that Bill Clinton did not. He put us on a fundamentally different path because the country was ready for it. Now, let me stop there. Is Barack Obama being just super slick and sophisticated and saying to the editorial board of this right-wing newspaper that the United States was ready for what? Reaganomics? Union busting? Murder in Central America? Or is Barack Obama saying the American public had degenerated to the point where they were ready for this kind of misery and death and destruction? He goes on, I think they, referring to the American people, felt like with all the excesses of the 60s and 70s, and government had grown and grown, but there wasn't much sense of accountability in terms of how it was operating, I think he just tapped into what people were already feeling, which was we want clarity, we want optimism, we want to return to that sense of dynamism and entrepreneurship that had been missing. Now, if some of you want to see that as a statement by Barack Obama as being not supportive of Reagan, and maybe you want to see it as being not critical of Reagan either, some kind of a neutral statement, if that's what you want me to buy into, I'm sorry. I'll pass. Adios. I'm serious. When you're addressing somebody like the policies of Ronald Reagan, that it had the net effect of just damn near destroying the union movement in this country, turning Americans, somehow turning them against their own best interests by appealing to racism, divisiveness, with that smiley-ass face he used to walk around in. If you're saying all this stuff about Reagan and you refuse to acknowledge his murderous policies, if you refuse to acknowledge his arming of Iran with TOW missiles in order to get money to fund his filthy Contras in Central America, if you're going to expect me, True Seeker, to believe that Barack Obama was not praising Reagan's policies nor condemning them, then you must think I am a fool, which I am not. I'm opinionated. To a large degree, I'm bigoted towards the idea of justice and common sense and fairness. But if you want me to believe that Barack Obama sat in front of this editorial board and said these words, and what they were actually, these words were actually a criticism of Reagan, you're out of your freaking mind. If you want to believe that, go ahead. Go right ahead. I choose not to because I am not a fool. Wow. This job never fails to amaze me. Back to your phone calls. Leanne. Leanne in San Diego. Let's see if Leanne's there now. Leanne, are you there?
I'm here.
Hey,
oh,
Leanne.
Mike, thank you so much for bringing this up. I knew you were going to be the one to bring it up, and I just admire you so much. Let me tell you what's going on.
Okay.
It's a joke. It's a triangulation, and you have to be a real dummy to not see it. This has all been set up from the beginning to put a black man and a white woman together in the same race. Had to be the biggest con game ever going. You know that's going to split the vote, and you know that it's going to triangulate. And I watched the debate while I was listening to you tonight on CNN. And one guy, a black man, one of the commentators, had it on straight. He said, you know who's going to, who is going to benefit from it all? Is John Edwards. You know why? Because people are so sick and tired of this mud fight between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, which has been going on since almost 6 months to a year. The American people, by the time the election are has come around, are going to be sick of it.
Well, that's not necessarily a bad thing. If people will start paying attention to what John Edwards is talking about.
But they don't want to. They don't want to put his message out there because they know he's got the right plan. He is the one closest to Dennis Kucinich. That's why they keep trotting Hillary and Obama. That's why they keep putting them on, degrading themselves, making Democrats look like idiots. And you know what? I am so disappointed that Democrats cannot see what's going on. Hillary and Obama are not going to win in a general election. And during the debate tonight, thank God, John Edwards brought it up. He said, in the national election, I am the most viable candidate to win against John McCain. That is the way it goes. Sorry if you don't like it, but he can win in the South. He can win more states than Hillary or Obama. So if the Democrats want to lose, which I think they want to do again, go ahead. Keep trotting Hillary and Obama out there. It's a losing ticket.
That is kind of, in a sense, I want to say sad to say, not because I think that Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, either one of them, are good representatives of their gender or their race or the Democratic Party. I've got to throw in gender and race because this is America. This is the United States. This is what we're about. And it's a shame that these two are out there. I think you're absolutely right. This mudslinging back and forth, these comments that are coming from America's first black president, Bill Clinton, this insidious hacking away at Barack Obama, Barack Obama's apparent ignorance of even recent history.
Exactly. It's pandering to the right wing, and that's why he made that statement about Reagan.
That, that was my take. That was definitely my take. Like I said, I got a couple of listeners tonight who think I'm crazier than hell.
No, but, you know what? I was listening to another radio show tonight, and a man called in, an African-American, and he was incensed by the comments by Barack Obama. He said, you know what, Barack? The milk isn't wet dry on your lips already to be out there trying to be president. Go back to the Senate, get some experience, and then come back in a couple of years. But right now, you don't belong running for president, and he doesn't.
I hear you. Leanne, I got to leave there. Thanks.
Thanks so much,
Mike. All right. Appreciate you checking in. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio.
Mike Malloy Show. Talk radio matters here.
You know, I hope Barack Obama sticks around in politics another 10 years. When Barack Obama is 56 years old, maybe then. And I'm not trying to be the very sort of patronizing that I accused somebody of being earlier tonight. But facts are facts. If you take a look at Barack Obama's political resume, there's not a whole lot of there. Wonderful. He was an organizer in Chicago. Great. He was in the state legislature in Illinois. Fantastic. And he's been in the United States Senate now for, what, 2 years? I have a friend who ran against him in the primary, in the Democratic primary in Illinois 3 years ago, Nancy Skinner. That's how lightweight Barack Obama is. Does he make a good appearance? Yeah. Is he a good orator? The political orator? Yes, absolutely. Does he hold his own against the other candidates? Sure. In terms of personality and style and enthusiasm, great guy, wonderful guy. In terms of president, give me a break. Sorry. It's just not there. And I'm just waiting till I get the emails that say, well, Malloy, the reason you don't back him is because you're racist. You don't like black people. It'll come, just like it comes when I criticize Israel and I get the email saying, well, Mike, the reason you criticize Israel, you hate Jews. So, you know, I'm waiting for it to come, so I just thought I would preempt it and say no. Mm-mm. If I'm alive 10 years from now and Barack Obama's alive 10 years from now and proves himself in the Senate and does something, hell, I mean, he's sharp enough, maybe he'll get a cabinet post in the next administration if it's Democratic. Great. But right now, President of the United States, no, I don't think so. Not for me. Maybe for you. If he's your man, vote for him. Bust your ass. Get him elected. Go for it. Starspace says, another anniversary day. Gitmo is 6 today, at least for the detainees. I just finished reading 8 o'clock Ferry to the Windward Side by Clive Stafford Smith, where he says that the first prisoners arrived on January 21, 2002. This issue of this facility needs to be discussed until it's shut down. And it's fading from the news with all the attention on the primaries. Yeah, and Guantanamo, will it be shut down? I don't know. Will a Democratic president shut it down? I don't know. I have no idea. We're a torture nation now. You know, just like we're nuclear armed. Once you do that, how do you undo it? Right? Huckabee. Email from Michael in Harrisburg, PA, who writes about the Mike Huckabee so-called populist campaign seeking to mobilize an insurgency of white evangelicals against the Republican establishment over in South Carolina. Michael writes, his campaign took an abrupt turn the other day after the former Arkansas governor directly appealed to voters on the issue of race, summoning his fellow candidates to stop calling for the removal of the Confederate flag from government offices. Huckabee said, quote, "You don't like people from outside the state coming in and telling you what to do with your flag. If somebody came to Arkansas and told us what to do with our flag, we'd tell them what to do with the pole. That's what we'd do," end quote. And, of course, he got applause. So this good Christian is telling the listeners that it's okay to tell somebody to stick a flagpole up their ass? Is that what he's saying? Is that what Huckabee, the preacher, is saying? Oh, my God. This Christ-invoking preacher suggesting that civil rights advocates shove flagpoles up their a body orifice? Is that what he's... Yes, it is. That's not very nice. That's not very mature. And this is a guy that said God wants to be the president. He's going to amend the Constitution. Back to using the back door. Huck, is that what you're saying, you freak? I don't think the Bible says anything about ramming flagpoles up your rear end. Huh? My God. And Huckabee, of course, has a great relationship with the Council of Conservative Citizens. That's the descendant of the old white citizens' councils that battled integration in the South, including Arkansas's Little Rock High School. Remember that? Nah, hell no. What did George Bush say? Some of that stuff is so old, it's not even worth talking about anymore. The Council of White Citizens, the Council of Conservative Citizens, in its statement of principles, says, "We also oppose all efforts to mix the races of mankind to promote non-white races over the European American people through so-called affirmative action and similar measures to destroy or denigrate the European American heritage, including the heritage of the Southern people." The Southern people, and to force the integration of the races, unquote. This is a group that backs Huckabee. As Huckabee stepped out and said, get these sons of bitches off my campaign. Has he? No, he hasn't. What he has said, if somebody came to Arkansas and told us what to do with our flag, we would take the flagpole and ram it up their ass. That's what he said. I put the ram it up the ass. Huckabee said, we'd tell them where to put it. I guess you really have to try to translate in order to figure out what he means, right? So this is your white, southern, male, Christian candidate showing great compassion for people who put their lives, including their asses, on the line for civil rights. Forget about loving dark races, Mr. Huckabee. I know for some of you Southern Baptists, that's impossible. This is about the law. This is about making the law equal. You don't have to embrace a black woman or a black man or a black child. All you have to do, Huckabee, is accept the law. But the law means squat to you because you said that you want to change the Constitution to be more in line with your interpretation of the Bible. And you're right, Huck. There's no 10 amendments. There's no Bill of Rights in the Bible. There's 10 commandments. And we know what they're about, right? These sick... this is our political system? Well, Mr. Huckabee, tell you what, I know what you can do. If you come down to Georgia looking for my vote, I know what you can do with the ballot box. Welcome back. About 7 past the hour. This is the Molloy program on the Nova M Radio Network. Let's see, who have we pissed off tonight, Kathy? Obama supporters, Clinton supporters, mainstream Democrats, Reagan Democrats, Reaganites. All in all, kind of a good evening so far. We still have an hour left to piss off the remainder of whoever listens to this program. Just a couple of one more item I want to toss in here, because tomorrow will not be MLK Day. This is from the Associated Press. I love this. While the nation honors the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. on Monday, three states celebrate another man as well. In Arkansas, Alabama, and Mississippi, King shares a state holiday with Robert E. Lee. The two figures seem to coexist in the very fabric of the Arkansas capital city, Little Rock. Streets bearing their names intersect in Little Rock, although Lee Avenue is much longer than King Drive. The pull of Civil War history, particularly the Confederacy, remains strong in Arkansas. I don't know why this writer's just talking about Arkansas. You ought to be in Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, South Carolina, Virginia. Anyway, the writer goes on, hats, T-shirts, and pickup truck back windows still bear the stars and bars of the Confederate battle flag. In 1997, a spokesman for then-Governor Mike Huckabee said that both men should be honored. A Huckabee spokesman back then said, they're both heroes, their birthdays come the same week, and you know the government likes to have holidays at the start of the week. But the president of the Arkansas chapter of the NAACP said in 1997 that it seemed inappropriate to honor King on the same day as Robert E. Lee. The president of NAACP said, quote, Dr. King worked hard to unify the country. I wouldn't say General Lee would be in the same notion of Martin Luther King. He was a great general and all, but he didn't come close to what Martin Luther King was about, end quote. Well, I don't know. He's a great general. Osama bin Laden's a great general, I guess. Then. Yeah.
really leads one of the handful of groups around the world that do this kind of work. That is, identify microbes that are deemed to be potentially useful in industrial processes. He actually did the original work, and it is indeed possible these days to patent microorganisms for specific end purposes. And he filed the original patents. What we've done is we've essentially licensed those patents and the rights to those patents exclusively for the production of ethanol. And ever since we did that, have been working on these strains of bacteria to bring them along and fortify them and strengthen the strains to the point where they're now reaching productivity levels that are at our commercial targets.
What is a bioreactor?
Think of it really as sort of a house or a residence, because this catalyst system that we're talking about, these bacteria, it's really a living system. And so what we've done is we've figured out ways to basically create a housing, an environment for the bacteria in which fluids and gases can come into intimate contact with the bacteria. As they breathe in the thin gas that is produced in the gasification step ahead of it, they produce ethanol, which we are then able to extract and isolate in a separation process. So the bioreactor is really a unique set of pieces of equipment that we've put together to make that whole biocatalytic process work very efficiently.
According to the Tribune, you're not quoted, but it says that you said that you expect to have a plant capable of making 100 million gallons annually by the end of 2010. I'm a firm believer in scientific innovation and research and anything that we can do to get away from carbon-based fuel. But 100 million gallons is that's really kind of not very much, is it?
Well, that's one facility, and actually the statement as quoted in the Tribune is correct. What to put it in context, what we've said is that the first demonstration facilities that will be up and running at any kind of commercial scale will actually be up and running at the end of this year, albeit at around a 40,000 gallon rate, fully integrated process. That's minimum scale engineering for these larger plants that we would size and have engineered at 50 million to 100 million gallons. That's a nominal size and an appropriate size, and about the same size as the corn ethanol plants that are out there today. And it's based on really the feedstock availability and the amounts of feedstock to your original point that you can realistically begin to gather and push through a process like this.
Mm-hmm.
We would envision as many as 50 to 100 of these plants one day producing very large quantities of ethanol at fuel grade levels.
What is the most serious, if there is one, polluting byproduct of this process?
The process itself, because it involves gasification, biofermentation, and then separations, has only a handful of points of potential byproduct or other waste processing. Because we start with gasification, there is an ash component that's going to depend on what it is that we're actually gasifying in the front end. If it's biomass materials like wood chips or corn stover or wheat straw, the ash content is 1% or less, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. If you get into municipal solid waste, it's hard to predict what those ash levels might be. It could be as high as 6, 8, 10%. So that's one output that comes out of the process that is a waste material. The carbon or greenhouse gas emission footprint is very favorable. You mentioned that in the previous comment. There's sulfur scrubbing here in case there is sulfur in any of the materials that we would remove in the scrubbing process. And the only thing that's really left is a little bit of wastewater at the end, because we do have to, in these bioreactors, sort of change the water in the aquarium every once in a while and process some of the water out in order to keep the whole system fresh.
Is there a website where people can get some comprehensive information about this?
we have a fairly good depiction of what it is that we're up to, and an animation that describes the process at coscata.com.
Okay, and let me spell that for people. It's C-O-S-K-A-T-A, coscata.com.
That's correct.
Is that right? Okay. And what's your next step?
Well, right now, we believe that since the technology is really at a stage where we are ready for commercialization, it would be impractical for us to try and go forward and do this on our own. So our partnering model is really in full swing. We're in discussions with a number of major corporations that we see as potential partners to basically build these facilities, get them up and running and commissioned over the next years. And so our intent is really twofold in 2008. We'll complete the
pilot. Hey, Bill, hold on just a second. Hold on just a second. We'll be right back. We're talking with Bill Rowe. Stay with us. Past the hour, finishing our conversation here with Bill Rowe, who is the CEO of Coscata Incorporated, C-O-S-K-A-T-A, C-O-S-K-A-T-A. For people listening who want to get a more comprehensive look at this, go to coscata.com and check it out. We were just finishing up, Bill. I forget where we were at the last sentence you were saying.
You asked me specifically about what our immediate plans are.
Right, right. So the next step, I guess with GM as a partner, you're not worried too much about any further investment.
Well, I wouldn't say that. But what I would say is that right now we've turned our full attention to really two things. One, getting our commercial demonstration facility up and running here in the next month. We want that running by the end of the year. And simultaneously getting the siting for the first couple of plants done with strategic partners, and very likely that'll go along the lines of specific feedstocks that we're most interested in to start.
Just one specific question regarding the bacterium that was developed by the people at Oklahoma University or Oklahoma State. These microorganisms, I would assume there are more than one particular bacterium involved here. Are they, if they're patented, does that mean they're genetically modified?
These are not genetically modified organisms. These were, in fact, discovered in the wild. I'm not exactly sure where. It conjures up images of all sorts of exotic places, but it mm-hmm. might have been somebody's duck pond. I'm not really sure.
Right.
What we've done essentially is purify those strains, basically culling the herd, so to speak, and then we've come to understand their metabolic pathways and basically through nutrition have fortified them and accentuated their ability to produce ethanol. The patents are a fairly common thing these days, and there is a repository of any of these patented microorganisms. That's part of the rules of the game when you get patents of this sort.
So any microorganisms into the environment wouldn't have any adverse effect?
These would not, for a couple of reasons. One, they are naturally occurring, but more importantly, these are the type of bacteria that cannot survive in the kind of air or oxygen-enriched air that we breathe. They can't tolerate oxygen. So, if there were the proverbial leak, these critters would not last very long.
So, this is an anaerobic bacterium, or is it just maybe partly? So,
it is anaerobic. That is correct.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, this is fascinating stuff. It makes a lot more sense to me, I think, from a number of points of view, not the least of which is the economic well-being of farmers in other parts of the world. This makes more sense than just taking corn and turning it into ethanol, because the first thing that will happen with that is all of a sudden there's not enough corn for people to eat, because it'll all go to ethanol production. So this idea of converting waste, to me, is I like it. I hope it works. I hope you're successful, and I hope the day comes when I'll fill up with your product, all right?
We can hope that. That's correct.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Thank you.
All right, sir. I appreciate you taking time. If you want to check this out, check it out. Check it out. Like you said, there's an animated explanation, coskata.com, C-O-S-C-O-S-K-A-T-A. Coskata.com. Check it out, all right? We have a break coming here? We do, don't we? In just a few seconds. When we come back, that fascinates me. Why do I have somebody like Bill Rowe on? Because the whole thing, I know. Ethanol, yeek, yike. The switch away from petroleum-based fuel has got. It's got to happen. We're kidding ourselves to believe that we can keep putting this off. I hope they're successful. Check them out, and if you see something that's really weird and freaky, send me an email. We'll be back after the break. Back to the conversation we were talking about before I had Bill on. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
Oh, I go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue.
For a place to attack, why not attack Iraq? They've got coconut and palm oil and crude. They invaded Kuwait, so let's not hesitate. We can blow up a country or two. If it's oil or it's Greece, we don't have time for peace. Waging war is what we want to do.
Oh, I go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue.
Everybody,
I go.
Every time we use a homegrown fuel, we'll be going helping our farmers. Someday a president is going to pick up the crop report, and they're going to say we're less dependent on foreign sources of energy.
Yeah, okay. Regarding religious madness, Art from Manhattan writes, hey, Mike, you wonder why? This religious madness runs so much deeper in the society of ours, far deeper than we care to see. Years ago, I attended a Catholic high school in the Midwest. Recently, I received in the mail a quarterly alumni magazine. In it was an article about another alumnus who had returned to speak with some of the students. You know, one of those moments meant to inspire young minds. The speaker had served in Iraq for several years before going back into the employ of one of the many security firms. His title was Defensive Designated Marksman. So it seems the good priests and nuns saw fit to inspire those young minds with, if I can translate Orwellian newspeak, a mercenary sniper. Truly inspirational. Mind you, this is just one of the many run-of-the-mill parochial high schools scattered across the landscape. Sometimes I think it's crazy to hold out any hope, yet I continue to despite all the madness. Art from Manhattan. Thanks, Art. Defensive Designated Marksman. Jesus. Back to your phone calls here. Where are we? John is calling from Fayetteville, Arkansas, listening on Sirius. Hey, John.
Hey, I'm normally a very positive, upbeat person also, but this denying of Kucinich this evening convinces me that, permeation of Supreme Courts in various states may be deeper than we thought with political operatives. I just spent my vacation between Christmas and New Year's in Mexico, and I came to feel, based on what has happened to Kucinich, I've come to feel all of a sudden that the corporations are really much more powerful than our government. And it's almost like the function of our government is to protect corporate interests around the world, and the function of elections is to select from a corporate-prepared menu the next free trade true believer choir master of the choir, and it's almost like corporate money is shaping the early parts of the election to make sure that that menu is an acceptable menu to the corporations, and it's very discouraging.
Well, I hear you. I would take it one step further. When you say corporations are as or more powerful than the government, I think, in fact, there's been a blending. The corporations are the government now. You take a look at Cheney's infamous energy convocation where they wrote the first energy policy, and corporate entities, as many as I think I saw the number 70 or 80 corporate entities were invited to write the policy. There was some half-witted statement that two or three environmentalists also were invited, but that was just to say, well, we invited them too. If you go back to Reagan, it was in the Reagan years, in the early 80s, where corporate America became the fourth branch of government and replaced the free press as the fourth estate. It became corporate America, and then they slowly moved into the point where they now run the executive branch and the legislative branch. I don't have any doubt about that whatsoever. The only branch that is still independent of corporate control is the judicial, but that's in the control of political fascists, whereas the other two branches are in control of the corporate fascists. I just believe this. I believe this. This is one of the reasons that Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi refuse to allow the Constitution of the United States to work its function and remove these bastards from office. So we're already there, John. We are there. That's one of the reasons I was holding out, and still do, probably more so than Lance from Manhattan, Illinois. I still hold out hope for John Edwards, even though I heard him say tonight something that just freaked me out. But he is adopting a very strong anti-corporatist stand. He's the one making the statements that we've lost our government, that it's now in the hands of these corporations. Oddly, he made that, he went ahead and appeared on MSNBC, which is owned by, it's a joint venture of Microsoft and NBC, while his colleague seeking the nomination was denied entry. So I'd go figure.
Well, I feel a whole lot better now.
You do?
Not really. But at least you see our Huckabee, which we here in Arkansas are more familiar with. You know, once I called you earlier that with Huckabee you get more religion and less brain power than with Bush, and I still stand by that.
Yeah, I think you're right. Hey, listen, thanks, John. Thanks for checking in. I appreciate your call, all right?
Okay.
Okay, take care. Faisal is calling from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Faisal, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing all right.
You know how committed and how much admiration and respect I have. I'm missing American Idol as we speak right now. So you know there's a lot of love out there for you, Mike. You know that. Seriously, I had spoken to you years ago when you were on the other network and whatnot. You know, as soon as they start to change these laws that take away civil liberties, starting with the Patriot Act and then move on all the way up to that Military Commissions Act, I was telling that call screener, I said, you know, when I think of politics these days and the elite, I think of Shakespeare and all the world's a state. You know, they get together, they contrive their little plan, their play, if you will. They put their script together, and then they put it out there for the people to gobble it right up. And the exclusion, and I'd also mentioned to him that the only people I really believe that would reverse a lot of those liberties that were taken away were, in my estimation, Dennis Kucinich, along with Ron Paul, to some extent. Mike Gravel, I wish, but they never, ever took him seriously for one second. His exclusion tonight is extremely disappointing. I find it that the fix is in, Mike. The fix is in.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about that, and I don't think it took the elimination of some of these other candidates to make it clear that the fix is in and has always been in. I think this is one of the reasons a lot of folks, and maybe I'm in this camp, maybe I'm not, but I think a lot of people are very resentful about the publicity that Hillary Clinton continues to get. She is corporate America's favorite candidate. You know, I've said before, I don't disagree with her candidacy because she's a female, or because there's an historic moment involved here if she gets elected, but because of her policies. I don't disagree with Barack Obama because of his gender or his race or his determination to pump in a little bit of positive hope into the system, but because he also now it's turning out to be evident that he is another corporate candidate. As far as John Edwards is concerned, I mean, Edwards has made it very clear, as Kucinich has, that corporate America is the problem. It's not part of the solution. Corporate America abandoned the American public when it decided to do what all corporations in a capitalistic system have to do eventually, and that's go where the labor is the cheapest. I mean, hello? That's one of the underpinnings of capitalism. So they abandoned the American worker.
How much, Mike, because I've always thought, like, I'm an avid listener, and I'm one that, you know, when it comes to religion, I am a devout believer in God, but I do believe, leave that off to the side, that should be an intimate relationship with one and their Lord. But as a Muslim, I can't help but think that whoever, to a certain extent, if they do not bow down to the Israeli lobby, to a certain extent, and I'm a person who, like, I like to bridge the gap. I like to unify people, whether it be Muslim, Christian, Jewish, atheist, whatever. You bridge the gap, and then whatever you believe that, you know, in your intimate moment. But the fact that the Israeli lobby, in my estimation, has so much power on and so much influence on who's going to be the next candidate.
Well, I don't know if they have a lot of influence on who's going to be the candidate, although you're probably correct. There is an awful lot of influence, though, on how people vote or in the House and the Senate after they have become senators or representatives. Right. There's an awful lot of pressure by the Israeli lobby on whomever happens to be president or vice president or in the cabinet of the United States government. There is no question about that. It was kind of a mutual agreement, though, for the longest time, because the Israelis were supposed to be our cohort in stopping the Soviets in the Middle East. It was part of the great game between the United States and the Soviet Union. On the other hand, there was an enormous amount of collective guilt where it concerned what happened during the Holocaust and the way the good Christians in America turned their backs on the Jewish refugees. But they did it assisting in the establishment of the State of Israel. They did it on the backs of the Palestinians. This is morally, this is rotten. It's absolutely rotten. I think most people who have an ethical sense are aware of that. Hey, I got to leave it there, Faisal. Thank you. I appreciate your call. Take care. We'll talk again, okay?
Bye-bye.
All right. Stay with us. I'm Mike Molloy. This is Nova M. Before the hour, thanks to our crew, Ian Huff, who engineered and answered your calls at our flagship station in Phoenix, KPHX, and he did that all week. Billy Foster, our technical director,
but add a touch of hate at Rome.
Chris in Minnesota, our senior correspondent, and Catherine Bay, who is our executive producer. This is the Jesus Christ Superstar Tour. All right, back to Bayonne, New Jersey, where we're talking with Paula, who's listening on the Internet. Where were we, Paula?
I think we left off at Jesus Christ Superstar and Bush bombing Auschwitz.
That was it. Now, the way I get it, he went to Auschwitz, where I question why he was there, since his grandfather more or less helped finance Auschwitz. But he's in Auschwitz saying that he probably agrees, or not, I'm sorry, he wasn't at Auschwitz. What am I talking about? He was at a memorial for the Holocaust dead. I keep forgetting he's in Israel. It just doesn't compute to me. But he made the statement that Auschwitz probably should have been bombed by the Allies. Now, I don't know how that... idea. I know there were some Jewish advocates who wanted that to happen, but I think they were in the minority, if I remember the history, because an awful lot of innocent people, well, I guess a lot of innocent people died anyway, right?
Yeah, but, you know, to blow them up, I mean, he should have said, you know what I mean? Like, he could have said we should have opened our borders and accepted.
Well, that's the thing. See, the hypocrisy here once again, I think most people who understand history, especially just prior to World War II, understand that boatload after boatload of Jews tried to escape and were turned back, were forced to go back and face their own execution. The boat that sat off the coast of Cuba for 2 months or however long it was because Roosevelt refused to allow them into the country. I mean, it's such a twisted history. And so few Americans are aware of this. I know people in the Jewish community are, but so few non-Jewish Americans understand the way we turned our back and just said, they're Jews. Who cares?
Oh, and you know, we can't have any more of them here, any more of them people. We have enough.
That's right.
It's just, it's just ridiculous. And what I don't understand, I mean, the man is irrelevant at this point.
You would think. I just wish he would sit down and shut up before he pushes the wrong button and we find ourselves in World War XII or whatever.
Yeah, we could just give him a toy, give him a new, like, PlayStation or something, a Game Boy, and put him in a corner and just say, sit down and shut up.
Yeah.
You know, even if, like, we won't impeach you if you just shut up. Don't open your mouth, you moron. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And why aren't, I mean... The Republican Party is on its deathbed right now.
Well, yeah, but we have yet. The Republican Party is sometimes like Lazarus. It has made more comebacks than Lazarus, that's for sure.
No, that's because the Democrats, you know what I mean, instead of being like Ben Helsing,
Well, the Democrats have the uncanny ability to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory over and over and over again. If they do it this time, we're doomed.
And that's why, you know what, and that's what's kind of annoying me about the whole thing that's going on with John Edwards. Because at least he has some fire in his belly.
Yeah.
He's not talking about compromise. He's not talking about reaching across the aisle. The only thing they should be reaching across the aisle to do is to punch him in the face.
Well, or serve him with a subpoena.
You know, and he's the only one. And they're, you know, what? They're just, they've been trying to push the man out of the race. Since the beginning. Remember when his wife, when they announced that his wife's cancer was back?
Yeah.
And the first reports were, oh, he's dropping out. Edward's gone. He's dropping out of the race. And isn't it sad his wife has cancer? And then when he said no, they beat him up for it.
Right.
And it's just so frustrating. Like, can they be so blind as to see that they don't have a chance to do to conservatism and republicanism what was done to liberalism? And the Democratic Party, although, you know what I mean, 30 years ago, don't they see that?
Yeah. I understand. I hear you.
I'm sorry. I just needed to vent because it's really got me frustrated.
Well, not just you. Not just you. Paula, listen, thanks. I appreciate you checking in, all right?
Thanks, Mike. You have a good weekend.
Okay, you too. Take care. I understand that frustration, sure. I take baths in that frustration. Robert is calling from Miami, listening on WINZ. Hey, Robert.
Hello, Mike. I noticed something that no one on the internet or anywhere remarked upon this yet. I was amazed in that ABC debate with Charles Gibson or Charlie Gibson, depending on what he feels like that day, with Charlie or Charles. He does a debate with the Republicans and immediately afterward, the same night, with the Democrats. Well, the opening line of questioning, only to the Democrats, he didn't ever say this to the Republicans, the opening line of questioning was this little phony presentation. Supposedly, experts say there's a 30 to 50% chance the next few years when you're president that we're going to be attacked by nuclear terrorism from a little group like Al-Qaeda, you know, not from a nation. And, of course, that's phony. I haven't read that since 1980. The next few years it's going to happen. This is one of these defeatist scenarios they're setting up for the Democrats. So his question is, if you're president, then when we're attacked by the terrorists, it was nuclear, an American city, a nuclear bomb in an American city, what will you do the next day? What will be your... I'm kidding. And this is unbelievable.
Try to find a doctor.
Well, I mean, this is unbelievable that he sets it up to put in the mind of the American people. I mean, I knew
Charlie Gibson asked that question. Really?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And let's put it this way. He phrased it slightly differently than I said, but that was what he said. He didn't say, what would you do to stop it? He said, after it happens, if it happened, then you're the president, and it happened, and after it happened, what would you do the next day? In other words, saying the Democrats can't prepare for it, this is the underlying message. You can't prepare for it to stop it.
Yeah, I hear you, Robert. Hey, listen, Robert, I got to leave it there, pal, because we are flat out of time. Thanks, Robert. I appreciate you checking in. Hey, do have a great weekend, okay? Take care. Take care. I'll see you Monday. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio. Keep it lit. Keep it lit. Oh, yeah. Have a great weekend, Kevin Kinney, wherever you are.